Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's L-O-N-E-S-T-A-R Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Dose of scares. I'm Eric Peabody, your host, and we're starting to pick up steam with Season 8 of Horror Hill. Tonight, we have a dastardly double feature for you to enjoy. To start our evening, we'll be reading The Ballad of Mr. Budokai by Matt Martinek. This story opens with a situation that many of us can relate to: being a bored kid and realizing that your friends might just be a bad influence on you. Sure, some amount of childish mischief is to be expected from any scampering youth, but it turns out that some activities, and more specifically, some people, should be avoided at all costs. Following that, we'll have The Soul Cages by Richard C. Morgan. Mirroring our first story, this tale also involves a young lad, though his situation is very different. Our unnamed protagonist has traveled with his father to a strange seaside village called Perdition Ridge, at the suggestion of a stranger known only as the Fisherman. As his father works the docks, our hero notices increasingly strange events taking place around town. What is the secret of Perdition Ridge? Who is the fisherman? And what fate is to befall our young narrator? Disclaimer: Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast, bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Listener discretion is advised. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to show your support and enjoy ad-free versions of this and hundreds of tales from our audio archives dating back to 2012, visit chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today and get instant access. Did I mention they're ad-free? Thank you for your support. From author Matt Martinek, I give you The Ballad of Mr. Budokai. He seemed like the gentlest of creatures, almost like a cartoon mouse or an Asian Charlie Chaplin, complete with black bowler and cane. His gait was a little awkward, kind of a stutter step on the verge of severe drunkenness, with the cane saving him from the pavement at every curb or crosswalk. You would see this tiny fellow around town, clomping about, minding his own, always with a big smile, which always overshadowed his pencil-thin mustache. He was just one of those characters, the ones whose histories were created for them on the lips of bemused children or bored housewives. I had no issue with him, but my friends, they did. You know how kids are, especially kids in a group. They called us the Three Musketeers around town, as we were never seen alone. The group consisted of yours truly, Charlie, Ricky, and Dom, which was short for Dominic. Amongst the group, however, Dom was referred to as Dumb instead, which was funny because he was the smartest of the group. Kind of a nerd, really. I guess it's like calling a big fat motherfucker tiny or something like that. Dumb was also skinny as hell and had the reddest hair you could imagine. He always said he was Italian, but I don't know too many Italians with flaming red hair and freckles. The other kids would pick on him constantly, but Ricky and I always had his back. Ricky, on the other hand, he was dumb for real. He was held back in kindergarten and struggled ever since. But the girls loved him and always followed him around school. They always said he was a cutie, and sometimes we would catch him at school in the coat room making out with some starry-eyed little girl. He just had those good genetics. Jet black hair, tan skin, and a little muscle to him too. As far as good old Charlie goes, well, I was pretty much a nobody. No looks, no smarts, no talent, nothing. Dry as a popcorn fart, invisible as the plague. It was that one particular summer, the summer of 88, when everything started to change. Me and my buddies, we were all 12. That weird puberty shit was kicking in and we were all getting moody as fuck. Every day felt like 1,000 degrees outside, and boredom was always the enemy. Unfortunately, in an attempt to ease their testosterone-fueled frustrations, my friends began to turn their attention to the town mystery, Mr. Budokai. It started innocently enough, with Ricky and Dumb making noises towards the man or flipping him off as we passed, but it progressed as the heat of the summer intensified. I was never one to pick on a person. It just didn't feel right. But, as they say, peer pressure is a bitch. So I followed as a lamb to the slaughter. The act that pushed things over the edge took place at the fruit market downtown. We saw Mr. Budokai there nearly every Saturday, and Ricky told me they had a plan. I didn't like the sound of it one bit, and I tried to get them to go with me to see the new Freddy Krueger movie instead, but they just wouldn't have it. I tried to make up excuses why I couldn't go, but my friends knew me too well. Oh, come on, Chuck. Why do you gotta be such a pussy about it? You got a hard-on for this weirdo or something? Ricky had such a way with words, God love him. I was stuck. The night before the plan was supposed to take place, I thought at length about this mysterious fellow and all of the stories I'd heard about him. There were so many possibilities floating around. That he was retarded, that he was an ex-ninja, that he had bodies buried in his backyard, or that he might even be some sort of war hero from his native country. All bullshit, I was sure, but I just wished my friends hadn't taken an interest in harassing this person that we really knew nothing about. I even asked my parents what his deal was, and neither of them had the slightest clue. It seemed Mr. Budokai was a puzzle no one could solve. That Saturday started out with a lump in my throat because I was nervous as hell. I didn't know what was going to happen. My only hope was that Budokai would simply not show. Unlikely, but not impossible. My friends and I made it to the market around noon, and to my relief, our target was nowhere to be seen. I tried to speed up the process and suggested other dastardly things to do on such a beautiful sunny day, but Dumb just replied, "Don't worry, he'll be here. He's always here." So we waited and watched. Fate would have it no other way, it seemed. At around 1, we spotted the little fellow stumbling his way up the street about a block away. The largest smile grew upon Ricky's face, and he walked away from us into the vendor's stands. "Where the hell is he going?" I asked. Dumb replied, "To get ammunition, of course. It's got to get messy." I watched Ricky as he bought a bunch of tomatoes, put them into a plastic bag, and quickly made his way back to us, grinning uncontrollably. Fuck. So this was their plan. Everything seemed to be in slow motion as Mr. Budokai neared the market, step by step, heartbeat by heartbeat. Ricky and Dumb each took a few tomatoes as they perched behind one of the stands, like snipers in wait. I stayed a few steps behind. I wanted no part of it. Even at that moment, I didn't think Ricky or Dumb had enough balls to go through with it. Just as that thought entered my head, Ricky yelled, "Hey Budokai, you weird little fuck, check this out!" A tomato sailed through the air as Budokai froze in mid-step and spotted the little red orb coming for him. Sploosh! Right on his black vest it smashed, as everyone at the market looked in his direction. The man made eye contact with us, but his smile never wavered, which I thought was the strangest thing. That singular tomato opened up the floodgates as Ricky and Dumb pelted the man with more and more. The tomato's entrails engulfed this poor man, and everyone started to laugh. Dumb motioned to me and yelled, "Come on, you pussy!" I wanted to walk away, but I couldn't. I came up behind my friends, put my hand in the bag, and pulled out the largest, juiciest tomato I could. One would be enough, just so they couldn't say I wussed out. I cocked my arm back and wailed that fucker right at the little man. Unfortunately, my aim was a little different than my friend's. My tomato hit Mr. Budokai square in the face, with a force that knocked him to the ground and sent his bowler cap into the street. His face was drenched in the gooey juice and dripping seeds, mixed with a bit of blood, I'm sure, and everything stopped. The laughter stopped. Hell, there was no sound at all. There were just the stares of the people, including my friends, aimed squarely at me. Mr. Budokai sat there, frozen, looking quite the mess, and he stared at me as well. But again, somehow, his smile remained. I ran from the market with a speed that could only be born of embarrassment and shame. My legs burned like fire as tears streamed down my face the whole way to my house. I could not believe what I had done, but I also cursed the kind of luck that would allow my action over everyone else's to turn a prank into something more. My parents knew that I was upset, but there was no way I could tell them what happened. How could I have been so stupid? I didn't want anything to do with it, but I took my part anyways. I hurt that man, and he did absolutely nothing to me.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. win big.
For the entire week after, I kept replaying the event over and over again in my mind. I wanted to take it back, to somehow make amends. I didn't want any part of the Musketeers either. Those fools were the ones who got me into this whole thing in the first place. They kept calling me on the phone, but I told my mom I didn't want to talk, that they were no longer my friends at all. I just sat in my room, alone with my guilt. What could I do? It would take some nerve and a whole lot of balls, but I settled on making an apology to Mr. Budokai. I had to. It was simply the right thing to do. I knew where he would be on Saturday, if he wasn't too embarrassed. Again, at that market. I would follow him until we got away from the crowd and tell him how sorry I was, that it just got out of hand. It was my only option. And so the day came, and just like the weekend before, that same lump in my throat appeared, but with nervousness that was much stronger and debilitating this time around. I was sweating, and my hands were shaking. I did not want to face this man, not just because I was embarrassed, but because the guy was strange as fuck, and I didn't know how he would react. For all I knew, he would bop me with his cane and beat the living shit out of me. Still, I probably deserved it. I made my way to the market, thinking of what I would say and how I would approach him, dreading the moment. Again, at first, Budokai wasn't there yet, so I set up shop, another sniper in wait. It seemed forever, and my heart beat faster and faster, with my nerves as raw as a rotting tooth. And eventually, there he was, waddling up the street. I felt like I was going to have a fucking heart attack. I stood by, out of sight, and watched him as he began to browse. He was so polite to everyone he came in contact with, and always with that damned grin. Another thing I did notice, however, was a small bandage on the bridge of his nose, remnants of my stupidity. After about a half hour, he finished up his shopping and made his way up the street with a few bags of groceries. I followed, about 10 yards behind. It was the moment of truth. As I continued behind this man, my curiosity began to get the best of me. All of these stories about Budokai began to enter my mind. Were any of them true? I could have approached him and apologized right away, but something told me to keep following. Where on earth does a man like this live? What of his family? Is it a nice house? I was going to find out. Mile followed mile, and just as I was getting ready to abort the mission, Budokai stopped at the gate of what was apparently his home. The house was meager, yet well-kept and clean-looking. A two-story brick, more than enough for one person. The yard was perfect, flowers and shrubbery out front. Nothing stood out. Part of me was disappointed. What a usual surrounding for such an unusual man. And so, with my heart in my throat, I yelled, "Mr. Budokai!" He was startled and actually dropped his bags. I quickly went up to him and he looked afraid for a moment until I spoke. "I'm Charlie and I'm that idiot who hit you with that tomato last week. It was a stupid prank and I just wanted to say that I'm sorry. I was going along with my friends and things just got out of hand." I was relieved to get this off of my chest. I waited for what seemed a lifetime for some type of response as he just stared at me confusedly. But then it came. "Ah, Charlie! Apology accepted. Believe it or not, I was that age once too. I have to say, you cut me up pretty good on the nose here." He pointed at his bandage. His accent was nearly non-existent, but you could still tell he wasn't born in the States. "I'm sorry, sir. I guess my aim was a little off," I retorted. Oh no, I'd say it was dead on. Budokai laughed, as did I. Do me a favor, my son. Make an old man happy. Come inside and have some tea with me. He seemed so genuine with his words. I smiled at the old man, picked up his bags, and followed him inside. There was a warmth about Mr. Budokai. It felt like I was talking with my grandfather. So there we sat, at Mr. Budokai's kitchen table, sipping tea and talking about everything and anything. He was one of the nicest men I had ever talked to. He had a sense of humor, too, which is rare for an older fellow. I was glad that things had gone so well. I have to say, you always seem so happy. You always have that smile on your face. Even when my friends and I were making fun of you, you still smiled at us. How do you keep your cool? I had to know his secret. Oh, Charlie, don't mistake the smile for happiness. I simply smile because I can't frown. You see, back in the war, all those years ago, I was shot in the neck and the bullet destroyed some nerves. The damage was quite severe. It entered at the neck and lodged into my face. Now, my smile cannot be wiped off. A tear fell down the man's cheek as he said this. My eyes redirected to his neck as I did spot the remnants of a scar. Apparently, he had seen battle, like some of the stories I had heard about him. But don't fret. I did my duty, and I do have my share of medals and trophies. Budokai's eyes gleamed as he spoke of his victories. I must show you, Charlie. Come see what I've done. I have it all set up. Budokai had already started for the stairs, and I must admit, I was intrigued. I followed my new friend up the stairs, but as I began to climb, I noticed a peculiar scent, almost like a piece of rotten food that was forgotten about. Mr. Budokai climbed the stairs excitedly, almost to the point of perfect health. The cane no longer seemed necessary. At the top of the stairs, he showed me into his bedroom. Everything was neat and tidy, unlike the conditions your regular bachelor would keep. He pointed towards the wall, and I didn't understand what he was trying to show me. It was just a stark, white wall. What was this? A joke? Mr. Budokai slid his fingers around the left side of the wall, and I heard a barely audible click. As he was doing this, I noticed the scent of rot growing, almost burning my nostrils. I was becoming more than uneasy. Something was wrong. He slid the facade of the wall aside, and I could not believe what I saw. Lined up in two rows on shelves resided six shrunken, mummified heads. The hideous smell rocked me backwards as my eyes attempted to take in the grisly sight of these skulls, the writhing looks of pain, the differing states of decay, the stringy white hairs that reminded me of the silk of a corn cob. I believe I was screaming, but I don't know for sure, as it was also very surreal. As I attempted to get my bearings, I noticed the shelving underneath the heads, six matching pairs of shriveled, twisted hands. See, Charlie? My trophies! These men were great, but I was greater. And look, I have some recent additions. Mr. Budokai gestured towards the corner of this hidden room, where I saw my friends. There, in the dim light, I could make out the faces of Ricky and Dumb, both in their own container of pale green liquid, streaked red from whatever blood was still present. Their features were distorted, their mouths frozen in their screams, but it was definitely them. It was at that very moment that my bowels let loose, and I messed my pants. I looked at Mr. Budokai, whose smile had transformed into something a bit more ghastly and devious.
"Charlie, it seems you have dirtied yourself."
Budokai chuckled as he raised his cane and brought it down onto my head with a great deal of force. I fell to the floor in disbelief of the situation. I knew I was bleeding badly. I could feel the warmth drip from my scalp. This man had me fooled. He was not the prey at all, but simply a predator waiting for an opportunity. I was dizzy but still conscious, so with all the strength I had for a boy of 12, I rushed the old man, knocking him down in the process. I ran slash fell down the stairs and busted out of his door into the street. My legs were on fire again, with the tears streaming down my face. I sprinted home, covered in my own filth, with the visual of my friends' decapitated heads floating through my mind. When everything was said and done, and the truth about the man came to light, the police found Mr. Budokai waiting patiently at the bus stop, with his everlasting grin still stretched across his face. As they approached him, he asked only about his newfound friend.
"How is Charlie? I hope his head is all right. Such a good boy he is."
You've been listening to The Ballad of Mr. Budokai by Matt Martinek. Matt Martinek is a singer-songwriter and author from Johnstown, Pennsylvania, whose passion is the creative process itself. Whether it's through song or the written word, Matt's works always find their audience. His writing credits include short stories for Siren's Call magazine, Hellbound Books, and Coffin Bell Journal, amongst many other publications. And now, from author Richard C. Morgan, I give you The Soul Cages.
"Titties!"
The dam finally broke.
"Titties!"
echoed the mouths of nearly 100 broken-toothed and missing-toothed, bewhiskered shipyard workers. It always started with one man. Then everyone in the shantytown tavern would raise their mug or hat or soup can, or whatever they were drinking out of, and echo the sentiment, and that's when the titties song began.
"Titties, titties, titties! Titties, titties, titties!"
It was a song where the lyrics didn't progress much further than the title. No melody. 3 beats on, 1 beat off per measure. All it meant was that someone in the group had reached the edge of his limit first, and now he was obligated to spot several others with his own allotment of rum or whiskey. They would stomp their feet and wrap their fists until they were too tired, or something else distracted them. You might have guessed that there was a shortage of women in this environment. You'd be right. No woman in their right mind, or with any shred of awareness for her safety, would have lived in our little shantytown, affectionately referred to as Perdition Ridge. It was barely safe enough for children, like me. Our little ramshackle huts of cinder blocks, corrugated tin, and wooden pallets lined the shore like the barnacles on the ships. More often than not, we were walled in by a skybox of fog that made our little place feel infinite and isolated, cordoned off in its own little netherworld. Things were fairly predictable after the titties song burst out. With someone else doling out the precious supply of liquor, others got careless about hitting their own limits. Then, whoever didn't pass out would go home to their own nests of rubbish. My old man never quite blacked out. He always managed to drag himself home to me, where I pretended to be asleep. All too often he would step on me, and I would do my best not to cry out. He'd slur the titty song a couple of times in defiance of the others, and, I'm sure, out of a measure of longing to go back home. I mean, home, home. I didn't remember much about our real home. I remembered that it was warm, lights were brighter. It wasn't damp and miserable, and I wasn't always getting sick. I kind of remembered Mother. When she talked to me, her voice was soft and soothing, not so much when she talked to Father. I barely remember the beach that she would walk along. She would take me with her. Her and Father yelled at each other a lot, so we ended up on the beach more often. It had this pale sand that was almost white and soft enough to sleep on. That's all I've got. I didn't remember hearing her say that she loved me and that we would see each other again someday, but I tried to convince myself that she had, and I just forgot. The only thing that I had left of her was a small drawstring bag full of that pale sand. I kept it inside of a small lockbox I found on the shore, which, in turn, I kept under a couple of loose floorboards. It was the only way to keep them safe from Father. It was the only way to keep anything safe from Father. Once in a while, I could get Father to talk to me. It wasn't often, so I would bullet him with as many questions as he could handle before he got annoyed. Where was Mommy? When could we go see her? Why did everyone but him wear just one glove? How did we get here? The only question he would ever answer with any clarity was, how did we get here? Everyone in town had been invited by the fisherman. That's how he had introduced himself. He never gave a proper name. He just showed up one day, shortly after Mommy had given birth to me. A strange character that wore a wide-brimmed hat studded with hooks and a long, flowing raincoat that was more like a robe than anything else. He carried a long walking stick carved from rotten driftwood that curled up and above his head where a small glass lantern hung. He showed up asking for Father by name, asked him how things were going for him and his nice young family. Father explained that things weren't going very well at all, which seemed to be what the fisherman had been expecting to hear. So he proceeded to explain that he oversaw a great maritime operation on the shore of the sea, where men could make a good living in a short amount of time. The catch was that it would require Father to relocate. He would have to live on site and be willing to work long hours. But business was good, so pay was high, and it would only be a few months before Father would be able to move back home and live off of his earnings. If he turned out to be a good worker, they could make a regular arrangement of him working for a few months and then spending the rest of the year at home with his family full time. My father was little more than a backbone and a set of thumbs. He eschewed work, and he loved to drink. The prospect of high returns for relatively low effort drew him in. Mother wasn't for it. She said that the fisherman was like his long-lost twin brother or something, full of fine promises that each ended in a noose. It turned into one of the worst fights they had ever had. And then, there we were, in Perdition Ridge. Father never explained why I wasn't left with Mother, and he got mad if I tried to pry. "She just wouldn't have been able to take care of you," was the best he could do. It didn't really matter how young you were. If you lived in Perdition Ridge, you had a job. My job was to set the cages, to try to trap crabs, crayfish, or any other unlucky animal for our dinner. The jetties were bristled with traps like ours, some weighted, some buoyed. Cages with meals that carried a price that the intended prey could not comprehend. It was the only reason I was ever allowed out on the jetties in the first place. I wasn't to be out on them unless I was setting our cages or drawing them up. I enjoyed it enough because it gave me something to do that Father wouldn't punish me for. But most of all, I wanted to catch a glimpse of Father at work. I wanted to be there when one of the ships passed close by, and there he would be, and I would wave at him and feel proud, and he would do the same. That never happened, but I kept hoping that it would. Setting the cages was fairly easy. You load a mesh bag with salted herring or haddock, place it inside the cage, drop it down, and just wait. It was another ordinary day when I was setting the bait that I really started to pay attention to what I was doing. The cage was nothing to the bait. If it had still been alive, they could swim free, no problem. The mesh bag was their cage. Whichever lobster or crab would come along would be ripping the bag open to feed on the bait. No obstacle to them. But they would be caught by the cage, heedless of the bigger picture. "It's a cage only if it can trap you," I mused. "You could be inside one, but still free to go if it wasn't made for you." I thought about the many things I'd caught in those traps. I'd pull them up, and they looked like they hadn't understood they were in a cage until it was too late. Then I thought of my father, and the look he'd get in his eyes right before he'd set to drinking. A grown man that could go anywhere or do whatever he wanted. But he looked like his body was his own prison, like his skin was a cage for his soul. The sharp sound of a bell broke my thoughts. One of the ships had snuck up on me. It was passing by in a wide arc. I wasn't used to that. It looked like it was going to come close enough for me to touch it. I hoped that would be my chance to see my father at work, and my heart rose. But it hovered in confusion. The ship emerging out of the pale wasn't like anything I'd ever seen before. It was monstrous, bigger than anything. It seemed to float on the air more than it floated on the water. There were so many boards missing from the hull that the gray of the fog shone through, showing up the many iron cages that hung on the vessel's sides. There were oversized flames all over her. There weren't any visible containers for them, no glass, no brass, as if they were burning open and unchecked. I couldn't see my father or anyone on the deck, but I did see lots of moving shapes in those cages. I thought maybe she had been hunting large game of the sea, and the cages were perhaps holding small whales and dolphins or other things. In a moment of brutal clarity, when the ship was as close as it was going to get, I saw that there were no animals in those cages of gridded flat iron bars, but they held men that were frenzied to the point of resembling animals in a survival-driven panic. They howled out to me. They barked at each other, some even attacking each other out of desperation. She drifted back into the opacity of the fog before I could piece together any of what I had seen. My very last sight of the ship was the stern, where two unusually tall figures came as if to see me off. One was wearing a wide-brimmed hat. The other bore something like a great curved blade that could have passed as a gigantic fish hook. They were blurred in silhouette, but somehow I knew they were both looking at me. The baying of the prisoners faded, but not without one final sound that chilled me further. The bleating of a goat. It was like the croaking of a raven, like the animal had been ill. My ears tuned in obsessively to catch the sound again, but there was nothing. The whispers of the sea were all that was left.
Ready to level up your day? Then join me and my friends at LoneStarCasino.com. That's LoneStar Casino, where you can experience the thrill of Las Vegas, no matter where you are. LoneStarCasino.com is an absolutely free-to-play social casino with thousands of games, daily bonuses, free spins, and jackpots that pop like fireworks. Hit pause on life and hit play on LoneStarCasino.com.
Lone Star Casino is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit LoneStarCasino.com for more details.
Sign up today for an incredible welcome bonus. Play bold. Win big.
I had heard that there had been other children in Perdition Ridge before, but at the time, I was the only one. I had something like a friend among those salty, smelly old men. His name was Murphy, and he was usually done with his work an hour or two earlier than everyone else somehow. Murphy stood out. He fed the superstitions of the others and profited off of them. He had transformed a good portion of his small living area into a forge, all the parts cobbled together from ship junk and whatever washed ashore. His specialty was glass. If you brought him sand, and it had to be sand from someplace important, like where you fell in love or the site of a fellow worker's demise, he could melt it and shape it into a talisman or a charm. All of his clientele were simple drunkards, so they didn't question how or why anything he made had any power. All too often he was called upon to craft glass eyes for men who would lose an organ of sight to either injury or infection. He himself had a glass eye, and it was an effective advertisement for his services, but I often wondered if he had actually been the one that made it. Each eye he made was as close as possible to the remaining eye of the customer. The one he wore had a bizarre shape to the pupil, one that I hadn't seen since my briefest sight of a goat on Grandpa's farm. That hourglass shape that I heard an octopus's eyes had as well. Besides the shape, the color was far off too. It was like something stolen from a sea demon. He was willing to have me around and talk to me for a short while before Father would be in. I got to talk to him in most of the ways I wished that I could talk to Father, but of course I still loved Father more. Soon enough, I went from talking to learning. Murphy gradually let me learn how to create glass from sand and shape all kinds of trinkets. He even showed me how to make an eye. I once asked him if I could make a glass eye like the one he had, and that was the one single time that Murphy got mad at me. It lasted for all of 3 seconds, but it was sharp and harsh, and it caught me by surprise. But then it was over. We never spoke of it again, and it never happened again. My apprenticeship took place all without Father's knowing, of course. He would have been furious. So, in secret, I learned how to make another kind of cage, one that people wanted to be in. I would go to bed with my mind on the bag of sand that Mother gave me. Should I make it into my own talisman? Would it ruin her gift? If I were going to melt down my mother's present, it would only be when I was sure what it would be. I was about to bring myself to ask Murphy for advice on what I should craft from my secret sand. What would do justice to the love of a mother and still not draw my father's disdain? Something like that. I didn't get the chance. Perdition Ridge took my one friend from me without a chance to say goodbye. I have no idea how it started. Everyone was at the drinking hole, which meant that I could step outside and enjoy the night and listen to the strange sounds coming from the world of drinking men. Somebody slipped into inebriation first and started the titties song. The rhythm was carried from horizon to horizon by the seawater. At some point, there was a sharp turn. The sounds of merriment soured, tinged by anger, fear, and something else. Almost what you'd expect to hear if a fire had broken out. Someone ran outside and rang a heavy, rusted bell hanging from the roof of the tavern. Another bell answered from across the water. I thought it was an echo at first. All at once, they brought old Murphy outside. Their voices were strange. You could have mistaken it for laughter, but there was no mirth. It was urgency, grief, and dismay in such high registers that it sounded eerily, fiendishly, like laughter. But it was no such thing. One and all, to the extent that their various states of inebriation allowed, they pushed, pulled, and dragged Murphy, whose voice was an amorphous howl of protest. But the peal of that strange bell only grew. The burning ship winked into sight from the murk of the night. Yes, the same ship I had seen while setting the cages. It came as close as it could to the shore without running aground. The mob surrounded the jetty and pushed Murphy out onto it. He nearly tumbled into the water. A shadow in the mist emerged with the light of a single ember that seemed to project itself for miles. It was a tall, towering figure riding in a smaller boat. Seabirds of some unnatural species clung to the smaller vessel and circled above it. The whole of the thing was moving too rapidly for a vessel that was neither driven by sail or pushed by oars. As it drew close, it became clear that it was being pulled by something else. There were men caught up inside a fishing net nailed to the hull of the ship. They swam as best as they could in the cramped quarters of the cords. Flailing, struggling to stay above water, their movements both keeping their heads above the surface and driving the ship forward. You could see the life leaving Murphy's body when he saw the foul boat coming near. The tall shadow stepped from the ship to the jetty. It might have seemed less tall if it weren't for all the skeletal birds that perched all over it. There was just enough visibility, just enough clarity of the air and sharpness of my perception to descry that the shadow was not just another grim reaper figure. It was something far worse. The birds weren't sticking around because they were official envoys. The thing wore a living, writhing coat of something that twitched and wrenched and squirmed like a giant squid caught in a web of hooks. Dark spots on the weird garment became mouths and nostrils, and, yes, eyes. The birds jabbed and plucked at any such eyes that dared to open. My overcharged brain thought I could hear the gaping mouths trying to scream with whispers that mingled with the ill wind of the sea. Then there was the hook. It was big enough to be a curved sword. It may have been the thing's hand, I couldn't tell, but it hung in the air like a cobra gathering itself for a strike. The thing glided towards Murphy, who was at that point squealing like a pig. He bounced off a few of the mob that were just brave enough to push him back towards the attacker before shrinking back. Despite being rusty and barnacled, and there being no sunlight, the monstrous implement flashed in its swing. It lodged somewhere between Murphy's neck and his shoulder. Murphy was pulled backwards into the embrace of the monster. The great hook became alive with subtle, even graceful and surgical movements. The birds formed a towering cyclone above the shadow, as their voices fought for space with the sounds of ripping and tearing. Murphy's screams became ragged, then became gurgles. A pile of something loose sloughed onto the jetty, which the birds zeroed in on. The struggling shape that had been Murphy was somehow a size smaller, and its movements were more frenzied. Its screams were an unnatural octave higher. The towering shadow casually opened the net that held the other flailing bodies and tossed Murphy inside. As soon as he made contact with the salty water, Murphy's former shape made gyrations and squeals that shouldn't have been possible. The towering monster then shooed the birds away from the grisly pile and slung it over its shoulder, got aboard the boat, and left. The phantom boat disappeared from view, but it was a long time before the mob dared to turn their backs on the fog. Father stumbled in and made his way to bed, chanting, "Titties, titties, titties," like usual. Except this time, it was like he was trying to forget something. I wanted to ask about Murphy, but somehow I knew that I shouldn't. Some days later, I awoke to the sound of something that didn't belong on the shore. I'd been dreaming about being on Grandpa's farm again, and I wondered if I were somehow still dreaming. I cast a cautious glance at the unconscious shape of my father, who was still snoring away, before I dared to go outside. There was a goat. I had heard its soft baas drifting through our window. It was a different sort of animal. The coat was rugged, coarse, and the color of dusty coal. Its eyes were bright amber. Most startling of all were its horns. They were like calcified tentacles that twisted and snaked. It lifted its head to look at me as it chewed, but I couldn't have imagined what it had found to eat along our barren little strip of hell. Even as far as the palate of goats go, there wasn't much to choose from. It bobbed its nose at me, which I took as a sign of friendliness. It had been so long since I had been in the company of a farm animal that I couldn't resist. I reached out to pet it, and it let me. My careful rubs became scratches on its cheek. When I rubbed its chin, it spit up something into my hand. I would have recoiled in disgust if I hadn't understood right away what I was seeing. It was a glass eye. More precisely, it was Murphy's glass eye. I looked at the goat in shock. Its response? It opened another eye. A third eye, directly in its forehead. Instead of being amber like its other two, this one was red as blood in the sunlight. Then there was a pink slit in its throat, as if cut with invisible fishing line. The opening oozed something watery and pink as it moved to articulate whispered words. "Guard it well, as you would guard your soul." I scarcely had enough time to comprehend these instructions before there was a sharp cry behind me. Someone had seen the goat and raised the alarm. I cupped the glass eye close to me as there was a flash of movement all around me. The goat turned and ran into the water. It was fast, but not fast enough. Rusty spears and makeshift lances converged on the animal with deadly precision. My instincts fired off before I could think them through. I ran home while the focus of everyone else was on the goat. Father was still sawing logs, so I lifted the floorboards of my secret chest as best as I could with shaking hands and put the eye away. The cries of the goat broke my focus. The entire host of men were all gibbering the same words like coked-up seagulls. "The goat! The goat! The goat! The fisherman's goat!" The goat itself was torn apart by the brute force of hands and rusty pocket knives. Part of me figured that this was the work of men who had been on a steady diet of fish for far too long. After all, the carcass of the goat was roasted and devoured around a bonfire of driftwood, stone, and metal that evening. But there was something else still, Something beyond basic hunger and desperation. Something that drove the men to mount the three-eyed head of the goat on a wooden stake. Something that made them dance around the head in concentric circles that were a little too well choreographed for drunk laborers. I was hunkered down in our shelter, trying to watch the whole thing from a distance. But Father burst through the door, sending it sailing across the room. He grabbed me with brute force and a deranged giggle, and dragged me outside to the cyclone of intoxicated brutes. The light of orange flames glistened on the flab of salty, sweaty bodies as they gyrated around the goat's head that wasn't much more than a shadow against the evening sky.
"Dance!" Father yelled at me. "Dance, you son of a bitch!"
So I danced. I was both terrified of my father and elated by the fact he actually wanted to involve me in something. The spinning air reeked of sweat and alcohol. Yet, in some strange way, I enjoyed it. I had unconsciously drifted closer and closer to the inner ring dancing around the head of the goat. Its three eyes stared out in independent directions, and yet I couldn't shake the fact that each of them were somehow trained on me. The mirth of the mob was broken by a single, persistent cry. A group of the sailors were sifting through the final remains of the animal, carefully filleting each layer of tissue and bone, searching for something. They weren't finding what they were looking for.
"There's nothing! Nothing! Come on, there's got to be something. We've been over this 20 times. It's not here."
"What about the head, then?"
"It's never in the head, you know that."
"But it's got to be if it's not here. It's the rules."
"God damn it, if you muck up the head, you've screwed us all. The head is sacred."
The tension spread like wildfire. I was compelled to look up at the head, just in time to see the oozing slit reappear in its throat and whisper, all too loudly, "Keep it a secret." That was just before a dozen clawed, drunken hands seized the stake the head was raised upon and began tearing it apart. Each horn was broken off in a separate hand. The three eyes were gouged out. The jaw was removed. The brain was excoriated.
"You fools, you fools! It's not there either! You've broken the rules!"
somebody shrieked.
"But it wasn't in the body! It had to be in the head!"
"It's never in the head! It's never in the head! You've damned us all, you worthless moron!"
"Shut up!"
And just like that, the revelry had devolved into rivalry, and violence tendered. Fists swung in deadly arcs mere inches over my head. Hands seized me in a powerful, painful grasp and whisked me away. When I could see straight, I was back in our shanty. My father's eyes smoldered behind a face smeared with sand, dirt, sweat, and blood. His yellow teeth shone like stars.
"Where is it?"
he snarled repeatedly, not even giving me a chance to feign ignorance. He started banging my head against the floor with each repetition. Each blow hurt a little less, and a ringing in my ears swept me away. When I came to, I couldn't tell if it was early morning or late evening. It was just gray. Father was nowhere in sight. My head was pounding. The sound of seabirds drifted into my ears. Something about it wasn't quite right. We didn't get regular visits from seabirds unless there was something rotting on the shore. I got myself decent and stepped outside. First thing I saw was Father, standing at the far end of one of the jetties. Gulls were nipping at his fingers as he raised them skyward. I thought for a moment that the birds had softly glowing eyes. As my senses ramped up, I detected that the birds actually had no eyes at all. The ghostly pale sky was shining through the openings in their heads. Only remnants of a papery, flaking skin clung to their bodies. The same light also shone through their ribs, like the roof of Grandpa's barn. As they bobbed and weaved at my father's hands, his fingertips turned dark. One of the ghoulish things dove again, and one of the dark fingertips was suddenly a fiendish white. The roaring waves washed the sound of my father's voice back to me. It should have been crying. It should have been pain. It was laughter, a rolling, wailing laughter, like a toddler playing with a puppy. Each bird that dove came up in an arc and guzzled down something that fell through their bodies into the water. One by one, they dove faster, turned more sharply, their feeding becoming so fevered that they reached a point that their papery skin was flaking off and drifting away on the sea wind. Father laughed harder, or cried harder. I watched until he was reaching up to them with a hand of gleaming bone, the birds frustrated in their efforts to find any more flesh. I pretended to be asleep when he came back inside. I was terrified that he would hear my heartbeat thrumming through the loose floorboards. I couldn't resist trying to catch a glimpse of his hand. He kept it hidden. When we got up for the day, he wore one glove. From that day forward, I never saw him taken off. I waited until I was certain that he was gone for the day. Murphy's shelter was untouched. I fired up his forge. I took both the sand gifted me by my mother and the strange glass eye. I melted them both down and crafted the glass into a star. I never saw the stars in Perdition Ridge, just like I never saw my mother, and like I would never see Murphy again. So I made something to remember them both. I strung my new talisman up with fishing line and wore it beneath my clothes. I was setting the cages along the jetty when a hand shot out of the water and grabbed my wrist. I jumped back in alarm. Two hands grasped at the jetty, and a body pulled itself out of the water. It was a woman. Despite the decay and the disfigurement, I could tell that it was my mother. I recognized her clothes. Cloudy though they were, those were her eyes. I was torn between joy and terror. I wanted to hug her, despite the ungodly odor emanating from her. I started crying. "Mama, what happened to you?" "Your father." "What? What's that supposed to mean?" She wouldn't answer. She just stood there, her empty ribcage expanding and contracting with simulated breaths. "Where is he?" she hissed. "He's working. He'll be home tonight." "Where is home?" I led her to our shanty. She stared at it for a long moment before she began walking into the water.
"Mama, where are you going?"
"Say nothing," was all she said. I watched as the top of her head moved so far out and then stopped. There, she waited. It was my mother, and I was glad to see her, but something about the whole thing felt off. There was no point in staring at her all day, so I went back to work. She sat in the back of my head all day. She was clearly dead. Something inside of me kept me from exploding with grief. It was somehow caged up inside of me, away from my heart, so I could keep going through the motions of working. And that's what I did. It was another ordinary day. Father stayed out late, drinking. He came home slurring the Titties song. He didn't ask about Mother, and I didn't tell him, though I really wanted to. Was she going to live with us now? Was she just here to say goodbye? I thought about her until I fell asleep. The silence that greeted me when I awoke was anything but normal. I was usually awake before Father, and his alcohol-induced snoring wasn't subtle. But quiet reigned, and it was deafening. "Father?" I said. There he was, lying on his back, his mouth wide open as usual, but no snoring. I watched the covers. They didn't rise, and they didn't fall. I leaned in for a closer look. His mouth was filled with something. Sand. Pale sand. My hand flew to my talisman. It was gone. The fishing line was still there, but the glass that I had lovingly crafted was gone.
"May I come in?" boomed a bone-rattling voice.
Ducking into our shanty was the fisherman. He was way too tall for our shelter. Any words that I had died in my throat. Shadows seemed to hug him, and they wrapped around his face under his wide-brimmed hat.
"I apologize for all the trouble, young man, but you have something that belongs to me."
He walked over to the bed, shoved his fingers into Father's mouth, and dug something out of the pile of sand. It was the fiendish glass eye I had melted down.
"Something interesting always happens when this gets away from me. I'll leave you to your work."
"My work? I'm not one of your workers," I said.
The fisherman frowned.
"I don't have a contract with you, do I? Oh, mercy, no. No, you were here with this gentleman. I see. Well, pack your things and be ready to leave at sunset."
"Where am I going?"
"Just be ready."
A cargo ship that seemed barely able to stay afloat took me away from Perdition Ridge. The fishermen had somehow arranged for my grandparents to meet me at port. They were beside themselves with joy to see me. The happiness didn't last too long before I found out what had happened after Father had gone to work for the fishermen. Mother was nowhere to be found. Nobody could find her. It was like she had vanished from the face of the earth. There was no way to get in touch with Father, and not for lack of Grandpa's trying. I told them as much as I could remember about life in the shipyard, but I didn't know how to tell them about Mother. Had her talisman worked because of the glass eye, or because the sand came from where she had been left by Father? I wonder how many people are stuck with stories caged up inside of them that they have no way of setting free. You've been listening to The Soul Cages by Richard C. Morgan. Richard C. Morgan is a copywriter by day and horror writer by night. He lives with his wife, kids, and cats in small-town USA in the endless cornfields of Illinois. What better place for writing horror? He channels the spirit of the Twilight Zone through his own storytelling podcast, Marsh Lights. You can keep up with all his written and audio undertakings at richardmorganwrites.com. Well, my friends, that closes out our broadcast this evening. Be sure to tune in next week at the same bat time and same bat channel for more stories to send a chill up your spine. In the meantime, if you're looking for more horror content to spice up your week, I recommend checking out the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel. There, you'll find a ton of past episodes of Horror Hill, as well as Drew Blood's Fear from the Heartland, Otis Geary's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, and more. Until next week, listeners, stay spooky. If you enjoyed what you've heard on today's program, please take a moment to stop by our iTunes page or wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. It makes a huge difference and would mean a lot to me. If you'd like to hear a premium, ad-free edition of tonight's and all of our other episodes, visit chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click the Patrons link in the menu at the top of the screen, where you can become a patron for as little as $5 per month and get access to our entire audio archive dating back to 2012, including past episodes of this program, all of our other shows, and hundreds of standalone releases, all of them ad-free and available to download or stream. Thanks so much for your time and for giving our sponsors a try today. When you support our sponsors, you help support this show, and that means a lot to me. If you happen to use Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube, you can follow and subscribe to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights there, where you'll get all of our latest updates and new releases, and have the chance to interact with us each and every week. As for me personally, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, username Viking Guitar, and also on Instagram as Viking Guitar Productions. In particular, if you're looking for someone to provide voice work for your own project, or are in need of audio production of any sort, it would be wonderful to chat. Until next week, listener, when we meet up once again atop the Horror Hill for yet another Dance with Darkness, I bid you good night. Sleep tight, listener, and if you hear scratching at your door, don't open it. The darkness may have found you, but it's up to you to let it in. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com today to learn more about our network and our other amazing storytelling programs. Tonight's episode was hosted by, and its featured tale performed by, yours truly, Eric Peabody. Selected stories have been adapted with the kind permission of their respective authors. Original music provided by Nikki McSorley and Eric Peabody. Finalization by Craig Groshek and S.K. Brown. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? I take submissions. Email it to us today at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. If you enjoyed what you heard on tonight's program and are joining us on your favorite podcast app, please subscribe to us to make sure you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review and a kind word. Your feedback means a lot to me. You can also follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and yours truly on social media to connect anytime and get the latest updates on this and our other programs. If you're listening on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights YouTube channel, Do us a favor and hit the subscribe button and the bell notification icon as well to get more spooky tales from me and the crew and another episode of this program each and every week. And don't forget to hit the thumbs up button to let us know how we're doing and leave us a kind comment. Lastly, don't forget to visit us at chillingtalesfordarknights.com and consider supporting the team by becoming a patron. In addition to helping us out, you'll get exclusive access to our audio archives and ad-free downloads of all of your favorite stories, including those you've heard on this program. As for me, you can hear more of my work on the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights podcast. However, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
You know what? It sucks to be bored. But when I get on my phone and play real casino games on SpinQuest.com, the time flies by. That 2-hour wait at the DMV seems like 10 minutes. Play your favorite slots, live blackjack, live craps with a live dealer. New players, $30 coin packs are on sale for 10 bucks. Play SpinQuest.com and you'll never be bored again.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.